गुरुर्विष्णु गुरुर्देवो महेश्वरः गुरुस्साक्षात् परब्रह्म तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। ध्यानमूलं गुरोर्मूर्तिः, पूजामूलं गुरोर्पदं, मन्त्रमूलं गुरोर्वाक्यं, मोक्षमूलं गुरोर्कृपा। ॐ सहना भवतु, सहनौ भुनक्तु, सह वीर्यं करवावहै, तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्ति। It's usual to regard yoga as a sort of a technique for meditation. Very often it is regarded as something even simpler or cheaper. If I am able to stand on my head, I must be a yogi. As I have often mentioned, it's more difficult to stand on our feet than to stand on our head. It's very easy to stand on one's head. I saw in Jerusalem a man who had polio when he was young, probably when he was six months old or so. So the legs haven't grown at all beyond that of a young child of 6 months or something like that. But the body has, above the waist, it's perfect. All his time is spent on his hands, upside down. All his time. Except probably when he sleeps. And he is more at home on his hands than we are on our feet. He's all the time upside down, all the time. Not even Shirsasana. I don't know if you know what's called scorpion pose, Vrischikasana. It's very difficult. He just swings up like this and his bottom goes up. And he walks very fast, runs, climbs stairs, climbs down, jumps into the dives into the swimming pool, does everything. By practice, one can achieve unbelievable physical efficiency and proficiency. I have seen people again who have lost the use of their arms, or either due to polio or due to accident, using their feet in unbelievable ways. They can shave themselves, comb their hair, paint, draw, all sorts of things. So, and yet, for people who are not, who can't bring their knees down, even sitting in the lotus posture seems to, must be a yogi, she must be a yogi. I still remember once I went by boat from Durban to Mombasa on the East African coast. It was hot and there was only a small swimming pool on the deck. I don't know how people swimming in swimming pools, because before you do this you are on the other side. What do you do? And there are so many people usually in any swimming pool. I don't know what they do. So I turned on my back and I was floating. It's quite easy, simple thing. It's only a balancing trick. I was just floating there, lying down, in lotus posture, lying down. It's very pleasant because the whole of the spine is in under water, under the surface of the water, and your the nose and the face and the top part of the body is above water, and it's very comfortable, very pleasant. A young man came close to me, started watching. What is this man doing now? He's not flapping his hands or feet. How does he lie down like this? He was watching. I saw through the corner of my eye that he was watching intrigued. How does this happen? As I didn't take any notice of it, he started disturbing, trying to put some water to see if this fellow gets worried. No, he wasn't worried. It wasn't too bad, and so I wasn't worried. And then, eventually, he came close to my ears. Are you a practicing yogi? I got out of my posture, stood up and said, what has this got to do with yoga? Why do you confuse this with yoga? Throw a piece of paper, cardboard, or dry wood, it floats. What has floating on water got to do with yoga? A huge ship, 20,000-30,000 tons, with a couple of thousands of passengers and so on, and stuff, gear, it still floats. What has that got to do with yoga? All these are essential. All these are important, extremely important. Meditation is important, yoga asanas are important, pranayama is important. All these are extremely important. But what is yoga? Yoga has its own meaning. And unless that meaning is brought into all these, it is still not yoga. We need to meditate. But can I shut myself up in a cave and meditate? I can. And unhappily, I can bluff myself that I am floating in the air or, you know, all sorts of hallucinations. You shut yourself up in a single room for a couple of days without coming out for a few days. Without coming out, you can get into a sort of psychedelic state. You can suffer from hallucinations. It has been proved by psychologists that solitary confinement in prison cells often leads to psychological or mental derangement. People begin to see things. They get completely disoriented. So it's possible for me, if I lock myself up somewhere, to suffer from the hallucination that I am meditating. I am not. It's possible for me if I lock myself up in a dark cave for a few days running, to think I am highly elevated, I am flying in the air and I am seeing air, I am seeing God, and that I am having astral travelling, all sorts of nonsense. One can easily bluff oneself. Is that meditation? Is that yoga? No. And what is meditation do to me? When I meditate, or when a spiritual aspirant meditates, he gets an insight into himself. He is able to see clearly And that is called clairvoyance. Clairvoyance does not mean that I know where you have kept your room key. I can't find it. I can't find a couple of addresses that I had kept in my pocket. My clairvoyance is not going to unearth those addresses. I don't have to read your thoughts. I'm struggling to not to read my own thoughts. Why must I read your thoughts? My problem already is how to control, govern my own thoughts. And somebody comes and asks, can you read my thoughts? Also, if reading somebody else's private letters is rude, reading one's thoughts is worse. I would like to read the letters addressed to her. Or the letters she writes to somebody else. But why must I read her thoughts? It's worse. Clairvoyance only means I am able to look within and my own inside is clear. My vision is clear. There is no confusion in my vision. How do I know that there is really no confusion? I don't know if I've told you this before, and it bears repetition. We had a wonderful visitor in our ashram in Rishikesh. This was way back in 1946-47. He was a wonderful man. Every morning he used to wake up, I don't know when he woke up, we used to find him on a block of stone, sitting like a block of stone. He was also like one with the block of stone. It was a huge boulder on the bank of the river Ganges, and he used to sit there, bolt upright. For at least 3 hours, at least. You and me, if you sit in Padmasana for half an hour, 45 minutes, the legs are already beginning to worry. An hour, it's already the maximum. There you are sitting 3 hours without batting an eyelid. Straight. Poker stiff. During those days, the master used to conduct a meditation class in the morning. But for him, meditation meant a lot of chanting, doing japa, repeating a mantra for a little while, and then meditating for a little while, half an hour, 45 minutes, half an hour was about the maximum. Prayers. All these compressed within an hour and a half. 4:30 to 6. Usually we would break up at about 6:15, and the master would walk past this man sitting, and very often he would make fun of him. Some of us wondered why. He seems to be an extremely earnest and serious spiritual aspirant. And here is a great master, the guru, a sage of self-realization. Why does he mock at him instead of appreciating him? He seems to be our envy. We envy him because he is able to sit like this for 3 hours. And yet the master, instead of appreciating, admiring it, is mocking him. Why is that? Then one day, this morning meditation class extended a little bit. I don't know what the circumstance was. And moreover, after the meditation class, the master was sitting surrounded by a few of us and he was talking. That gentleman got up from there, 7 o'clock. He got up from there and walked in. The master said, Samadhi. You are in deep, deep Samadhi. And that man thought the master was appreciating him. So he said, yes, Samadhi. How long do you sit? 3 hours, Samadhi, 3 hours. Oh, 3 hours. Yes, Samadhi, he thought that the master was appreciating him. So he began to, come up with all sorts of statements. Yes, Samadhi, I've been doing this for years now. 3 hours every morning, 4 to 7. Wherever I am, I meditate. Oh, wonderful. Oji. Only some of us knew that it was a preliminary to something else coming. It was not all that admiration. Something else is coming. Suddenly, the master grew serious and said, what is this? Look at him, look at him. Yes, he says he's meditating. Look at him. Sleepy, drowsy, dull. Hey, what meditation is this? Then everybody got stunned, shocked, and everybody began to listen. Is something else coming now? There is no appreciation, there is no admiration, there is not even a fun. It's something serious. Now what's going to happen? I still remember what he said. It was wonderful. He said, do you know what meditation means? Meditation means touching God. Touching God. Touching the infinite. Touching the omnipotent reality. There's a beautiful expression in the Bhagavad Gita. Brahma samsparsham. Atyantam sukham ashnute. He who meditates touches that Brahman or the infinite reality. And it is endless bliss. Bliss which cannot be described. That is meditation. And here comes a man who says, I've been touching that God for 3 hours, not 1 minute. He is dull, drowsy, sleepy. How is that possible? If you touch that supreme power, for half a minute you are charged. And he said, you would have such energy and power and feeling of bubbling enthusiasm that you would want to roll up the whole, this is what he said, you would want to roll up the whole world as a piece of leather. He might want to take up the earth itself and use it as a tennis ball. Such power, such energy, such bliss must radiate from you if you even touch that supreme power for half a minute, 1 minute. You say you have been sitting and meditating for 3 hours every morning. With the result that you are dull and sleepy and stupid. Then he said, Aji, give up all this foolishness. I still remember this. It was very beautiful, very inspiring. Yeah, give up all this foolishness. And do some work. Don't waste, in other words, don't waste your time sitting on a block of stone. Another stone can sit on that block of stone even better. No? Even longer than you can. An inanimate object, like a stone, can sit on top of that stone even much, much better, much longer. Don't waste your time. He said, then, take some water and fill up the kitchen tank. You will get samadhi quickly, more quickly, he said. Exactly. Exact words were used. If you take water from the Ganges and fill up our kitchen tank, you will get samadhi more quickly, he said. Why? What was the idea? One can mistake lethargy. One can mistake dullness. One can mistake a sleepy state for samadhi, for meditation. I don't know if you have seen imbeciles, idiots, born idiots, congenital idiots, or I don't know, do you have any serious mental hospitals here? Anyone has seen anything there? If you go to some of these chronic mental hospitals, where chronic mental patients are kept, who have had dozens of electric shocks and tranquilizers and pills and tablets and all sorts of things, you will find them sitting like this. They are too far gone. They are breathing stones, breathing statues. Their thinking power has been paralyzed. Their mind has been paralyzed. Their body has been paralyzed. There's nothing there. It's just breathing. That's all. That's easy. It's easy to mistake this for samadhi. What is the difference? How does one know? Oneself. I'm not saying I must judge you or you must judge me. No. That's waste of time. Foolishness and waste of time. How does one know oneself? How do I know? If what I am doing, sitting there, is meditation or not meditation, one can only know from what happens afterwards. This is probably the case, probably, I don't know, I'm not talking from first-hand knowledge, with attempts at gaining the superconscious state through drugs, to artificial means. I don't know, I'm not talking, I've only seen something in India. One day, I saw a man naked and his body smeared with ashes, his beard, matted locks and all sorts of things, and looking straight at the tip of his nose, sitting perfectly straight for not less than 10 hours. At a stretch, he was sitting there since the morning, and I saw him right through the afternoon, late afternoon. He was still there, sitting there. And I had mistaken that he was not only a great yogi, but probably an incarnation of God, descended from, raised straight from heaven. And a few days later, someone referred to him as a rascal. I said, why do you say so? Oh, he was a rascal. I said, how can you say that? He was sitting there for 10 hours and meditating. He said, this man who told me, he said, you are also taken in by this. It's nothing. There is a certain drug which if you take, whatever you are doing, at the time you take the drug, you will do for the duration of its effect. So that if you start smiling when you are taking that, you will keep smiling for 10 hours. Very nice. Huh? Or if you sit in the meditation posture and take the drug, you will stay like that for 10 hours. Does it mean that by merely sitting there, my consciousness is elevated, uplifted, expanded? No. Not merely that. A drug or the habit of sitting like this. Practice of yoga postures. Even this persistent habit of sitting down with one's back straight and so on. All these can enable us to achieve correctness of posture. And also a certain quiescence of mind, both of which are invaluable for meditation. I want you to get this very clearly. A certain steadiness of physical posture, rhythmic breathing, quietness of mind, all these are invaluable for meditation. But there is something more. It's like the table being laid, lovely tablecloth, first class crockery and silver. Everything is perfect. All these are essential. You can't eat on the floor. You need some crockery, some plates and some cups and saucers and so on, and knife, spoon, fork. All these things are essential, no doubt. But where is the food? Huh? Without this food, all these things are ornaments for the table. Similarly, perfect physical posturing, controlled, rhythmic, graceful breathing, deep breathing, quiescence of the mind, all these things are invaluable, probably even indispensable. But where is meditation? That must come. How do I know if I was meditating or non-meditating? If I meditate, I come in tune with the infinite power. Infinite because it is not confined to this body. It is not in me, I am in it. And even this thing called I derives its existence, not only its power, its very existence is derived from that. Its very existence is dependent upon that. In exactly the same way as the existence of every cell of this body is dependent upon the livingness of the entire organism. There is a cell here, millions, hundreds of them, in the tip of my finger. So that if you take a rusty nail and poke the finger, those cells will rebel and react so powerfully that the tip of the finger will become red. Furious activity will go on there without even my volition. And fighting goes on to throw out this foreign matter that is trying to invade this physical body. These cells have such power, such tremendous power. But the moment death takes place, all these cells are dead instantaneously. So that the existence of these cells, the livingness of these cells is entirely dependent upon the whole organism. And when in meditation, you rise to be in tune with the infinite, instantly you realize that my power is derived from that infinite. My existence is derived from that infinite. In other words, I am just an idea. Just as you can talk of a single cell in your body. But a single cell as such has no existence apart from the body. It's a piece of matter. It's only when it is part of this body I am able to grasp, I am able to lift this bouquet of flowers. Not I, but these fingers. But if this hand is amputated and the fingers are lying there, they have no power whatsoever to lift this bouquet of flowers. It is their connection. It is their, the fact of their being part of this whole organism